Man, I'm really happy that we decided to do this episode of Ragnarok outside.
Oh, me too. It's gorgeous out.
It is quite lovely.
Wait a minute, see. Though. What are those clouds up there?
I don't know. Do they kind of look like butts?
Poop storm! Poop's a poop! Run for the hills! It's a poop storm!
Holy crap! Oh god, we gotta get out of here! Get inside!
God,
oh my god, it's everywhere!
Welcome to Ragnarok, your home of the Nerdpocalypse.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 18 of Ragnarok, Geek Century Part 3, or as we like to call it, Bloodthirsty Revenants from Beyond the Moon.
I don't actually like calling it that, I just do.
Yeah, that's true. The Bloodthirsty Revenants part is much more unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of non-specific, too. It doesn't really say if there's zombies or vampires or, you know, just animated corpses.
Well, I mean, once they get bloodthirsty enough, I kind of stop caring what they are exactly and just want to get away from them.
Mm. I mean, I guess they're bloodthirsty and not brain thirsty, so that kind of eliminates zombies.
That's true. But... and they're from beyond the moon, so they're probably not your typical vampires, because they have to, if not be able to survive in space, and at least have the technological capabilities for space travel.
Mm. They might be.
You know what was big about space travel was they talked a lot about it from 1951 to 1975.
Yeah, but we're on the Bloodthirsty Revenants right now, Ed. Stop it with your heavy-handed segues.
Handy-heaven?
Yes, your handy-heaven segues.
My handy-heaven segues are amazing.
No, they're not. They're the worst part of the show.
That sounds like an IKEA set, Alex. Handy-heaven.
Don't. I've been reading the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series. Please, don't mention IKEA sets to me. I'm going to go into flashbacks.
I'm going to get a boner.
Okay, now it's time to move on. See, Meyer knows how to segue, Ed. Anyway, speaking of boners, we're going to continue our retrospective of the Geek Century tonight with Geek Century Part 3, which covers 1951 to 1975. And now you're probably all sitting at home thinking, nothing happened from 1951 to 1975, but you're fucking wrong.
You know what they're also probably thinking? What are our names?
I don't know, but should we tell them?
Nah.
Well,
I'm going to break the mold and say my name.
Don't do it.
I'm Ryan. Fine, I'm Meyer.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Ed.
Yeah, peer pressure.
I feel so dirty now.
Eric's not here. Yeah, they're also probably wondering where the hell Eric is.
I don't know if anyone was actually wondering that. But now that you brought him up, I don't remember what our reason for him not being here was.
I think he had the Talaxian flu.
Right. Talaxian plague.
Right.
We didn't decide on one. We just forgot about it.
Yeah, we just switched topics.
Either way, he's, you know, hunched over in his bathroom, shitting out just feet of his intestine, and it's awful.
Yeah, he really needs an emergency medical hologram to set him straight.
Mm-hmm. It's a good look on him, though.
Or Gates McFadden.
Gates McFadden. She's an expert barista.
Yes, she's an expert barista and is the only human who has the cure for the Talaxian plague.
All right, well, speaking of the Talaxian plague, that sort of does actually segue.
Ed, we already had our segue established before Maya rudely interrupted with our names. Yeah. Speaking of boners.
Yeah, my boner.
Yeah, speaking of Meyer's hard-throbbing erection, we are today going to be talking about the Geek Century 3. And Ed, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about science fiction television during that time?
All right, so from 1951 to 1975, you know, obviously that was sort of the beginning of television, so why not the beginning of sci-fi television? And most notably, we can look at our heavy hitters like Star Trek, which Doctor Who, and then the Irwin Allen shows. Now, if you don't know what the Irwin Allen shows are, those were those unforgivably campy but lovable shows like Lost in Space and The Time Tunnel.
I loved Lost in Space.
And I love The Time Tunnel.
They're unforgivable.
They are. I didn't say that they're not lovable. I said they're unforgivably campy and lovable. But why don't we start with Star Trek, because that's sort of the big nerd focus, or one of the big nerd focuses. It was created by Gene Roddenberry in 1964, even though it would premiere in 1966. The pilot episode, which had a very different cast than it ended up having, was dismissed as being too cerebral. Eventually, it was picked up in 1966 with a new cast. It was canceled after three seasons in 1969, despite being extremely popular.
That's because they couldn't deal with Captain Kirk's diction.
Yeah.
Or lack thereof.
And, you know, it took him too long to formulate a sentence, so they canceled it.
The first three seasons were actually just one sentence.
Exactly.
They just ran out of ways to get Kirk's shirt off.
Yeah, that's the actual reason, was William Shatner started to get a paunch and they didn't want to see him without a shirt anymore. He was briefly revived again, though, in from 73 to 75 with a little-known animated series.
Which is now on Netflix Instant.
As is the regular Star Trek. As is all Star Trek.
All of the series are on, and all the movies, I believe. But after the show ended, Star Trek went to bed for about 12 years, much to the dismay of its fiercely loyal supporters. Speaking of long hibernating sci-fi shows that came back better than it started, let's look at Doctor Who.
Let's.
Yeah, it's one of our favorites. Sidney Newman is the creator. He created this iconic character in his Blue Box. Same year that, in 1963, I don't know why this says 1966, originally with the intent of making it, marketing it as edutainment, which is educational entertainment. Quickly, it became something else. And then the Doctor spent about 23 years from 66 to 89 reinventing himself seven times and literally changing faces.
Wow.
Oh, man, that's edutainment right there.
Because, mm-hmm. as we all know, you actually do change faces when you die.
Continue.
I was waiting for some sort of reaction, but...
No, we decided to let that one stand as is.
All right. The show went through several reformations and managed to stay very timely and modern through most of its run, but never...
You wouldn't know that looking back now.
What?
So you wouldn't think that looking back now.
No, but during the time, it was timely and modern.
Yes.
That's why it's timely. But it never lost that element of wonder and camp that made it so loved. Even the episodes now have camp to it. It was finally put to bed in 1989, but then it got revived again twice. Once in 1996 and once in 2005. Now, last and least, there are the Irwin Allen shows.
I want you to stop talking shit about the Irwin Allen shows.
I'm not saying that they're bad, but compared to Star Trek and... Doctor Who?
That's exactly what you're saying. Your tone speaks volumes, Ed.
I'm sorry.
Come on, Ed. How can you compare Land of the Giants unfavorably with Star Trek?
All right, well, the genius Irwin Allen. In the late 60s, Irwin Allen had three fairly successful and entertaining television shows. Lost in Space, Land of the Giants, and The Time Tunnel. They would be over by 1970 and almost completely forgotten by 1975.
Lies.
The exception, of course, being Lost in Space, which stayed popular and was put into syndication forever and even had a brief crappy rebirth in 1998.
We don't speak of the movie, though.
Spiders!
What did I just say?
With Gary Oldman and what's-his-face from Friends.
Yeah.
Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc and
I remember.
And Stone Man, what's-his-name, William Hurt.
That was like Matt LeBlanc's big breakout movie role. Like, I could do more than just comedy on Friends.
And then Joey was his big breakout TV show.
Yeah.
Wasn't Matt LeBlanc also in a movie about a monkey who played baseball?
I wonder what he's doing right now.
Matt LeBlanc?
Yeah.
He's on a new TV show that's doing pretty good.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's playing a character. He's playing himself, like a version of himself.
Good for him.
Just to tell you a little bit about these shows, if you don't know what they're about.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about these shows, in case we don't know what they're about?
Star Trek, as it premiered on NBC, told of the idyllic future where Earth was united under a peaceful interplanetary banner. Not only was Earth united as one people, but they were aliens that made up the United Federation of Planets. The series followed the five-year mission of a Federation starship called the Enterprise.
Well, three-year mission.
Hey-o!
A three-hour tour.
Well, no, because the animated series continued their five-year mission. It was a two-year...
Okay.
Show. Yeah. The crew of the Enterprise, led by Captain Kirk, are explorers whose mission is to seek out new life and new civilizations and boldly go where no man has gone before.
Or woman.
which would later be changed to No One to keep up with sexual revolution. As much as I love Star Trek, though, the base idea for it is nowhere near as unique and creative as the story of Doctor Who. It's a fascinating and simple concept. It's the story of an alien, a Time Lord to be exact, named the Doctor. He is a highly evolved species of humanoid with complete control over time and space. The Doctor and his companions travel through time on his TARDIS, which stands for Time and Relative Dimension in Space, and try to survive history and the future on Earth and on distant planets. Now, the story of the Irwin Allen shows, not to defame him any more than I already have.
You better watch what you say, boy.
Talking shit about him.
They're sort of all the same.
What?
Basically, scientists, or a scientist, create some sort of device that allows mankind to make some sort of wondrous trip to another place. But something goes terribly wrong. While testing the device, the scientist/scientists and his cohorts end up trapped wherever they sent themselves.
Okay, well now, excuse me. In Lost in Space, it wasn't just a scientist and his cohorts. It was a scientist's family.
Oh, yeah.
That show was about family values. That was the Swiss Family Robinson in space with a robot.
That's why that one stood the test of time and is still somewhat relevant.
Yeah, and Land of the Giants was about a routine space plane flight to London that got sucked into a wormhole, so there was no device.
Still, I'm just more or less some sort of accident within this routine sort of...
Yeah, that's okay.
Scientific endeavor.
We've already debunked your thesis. You might as well keep going.
Is Steve Irwin dead?
Yes.
But
I hope he comes back and as a zombie and bites Ed.
Why would Steve?
But you know what? Okay.
I think you mean Irwin Allen. You know,
I hope to say a little bit. No, I want Steve Irwin to do it.
All right, well, Ed, you better watch out for any
crocodile hunters coming after you.
Steve Irwin is going to come and turn me into a zombie.
Okay. Yeah.
But we already know his weakness is a manta ray stinger through the heart.
Ooh.
Too soon?
Ooh. I think that might be the worst joke we've ever made on this show.
Maybe on air.
Yeah.
Too soon.
Well, on air, definitely. So, but, you know what, let me jump ahead. Let me make it up to Steve Irwin / Irwin Allen.
No, you have to make it up to Steve Irwin now, Ed. You're dealing with a totally different authority.
Oh, no. Is Steve Irwin one of the bloodthirsty revenants?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you think Australians go when they die? They go beyond the moon.
That explains a lot.
I will say this for Irwin Allen, though. His archetypes have made for some really fun sci-fi stories and have inspired some of my favorite shows, like Sliders. And they're entertaining for what they are. Like Doctor Who, it's the characters who made his shows. That's why Lost in Space has had the most staying power. It had memorable characters like the robot and Dr. Smith.
Damn straight.
These shows all in some way have impacted sci-fi media. All of them, in one way or another, had an impact on Glenn Larson, who created the original Battlestar Galactica. And even though that show is kind of cheesy, we got the amazing remake.
Remake?
Not to mention... What?
We got the amazing remake?
Remake.
Remick.
Sound like you said remick.
Remick.
Which, as remick an Irish person, I find rather offensive.
Not to mention, it also impacted shows like Quantum Leap and Sliders and Lost and Fringe, the later Trek series, the works of Douglas Adams, and a whole hell of a lot more than I can think of. So, Irwin Allen is a I give him props. I should not have defamed him as much as I did, and I apologize.
That's right.
Well, I got to deal with Steve Irwin now.
Yeah, you're dealing with a different Irwin.
But one thing that but like I said, the latter Star Trek series, I'd like to go back to that for a second and talk about Star Trek and the impact that it had on geek culture. If you don't know the impact Star Trek had on geek culture, then you must have spent the past 40 years stranded in the Delta Quadrant.
Heyo, I get it.
And if you don't understand that reference, then you're probably listening to the wrong podcast.
And if you don't get that Delta Quadrant reference, you probably spent the last 40 years on the Delta Quadrant. Oh, wait.
But with 4 spin-off series and fine, 11 movies, even though I don't really like to include Nemesis.
Really?
And it's got another one on the way.
Yeah, Nemesis is the one you don't want to include?
Wow.
Yeah.
Not the whole undiscovered country where they go to the center of the galaxy and everything's awful.
That one's bad. Nemesis is unforgivable.
What about the one where they meet God? That's a pretty
that's the same.
That was
the same.
That's undiscovered country.
That was pretty.
That bad. One's bad. Nemesis is unforgivable.
I'd rather deal with Picard's clone than Vigor.
Ugh. Well, I stand by what I say.
All right.
What about that one place where they don't like machinery, and they want to get out? It's a new next generation movie. It goes like a planet.
And oh, Generations.
Yeah.
With the ribbon.
Yeah.
Well, that one's good until Kirk dies.
No, that's not the one I'm talking about. It's the one. It's
Insurrection.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's.
I mean, that one's not great, but it's not bad.
Dowdy out. Continue.
So anyway, with four spin-off series and 11 movies, and another one on the way, it's fairly obvious Star Trek isn't going anywhere. Since 1966, this franchise has been reinventing itself. That seems to be a theme. While still staying true to Gene Roddenberry's ideal of the future and humanistic ideals. From episode one, it had an impact because it didn't just have humans and aliens. The Enterprise was nicknamed the Starship Earth by the cast and crew. The crew of the show, not the crew of the Enterprise. Because it represented humanity at its best, and it only pushed the envelope more as the franchise went on. Had the first on-air interracial kiss. Further series challenged perceptions about gender, race, identity, and sexuality. I don't know if you remember, there was an episode of Next Generation where Riker fell in love with a person from a species who were completely androgynous.
Oh my.
There was also the episode of the original series where George Takei ran around being a swashbuckler.
Yes, that one challenged something.
Yeah.
Mike Boner.
Oh, and we're back to Myers Boner.
Always taking it back. That's what I love about Ragnarok.
Always bringing it back to the boner.
Yep.
I will say, though, the newest films do seem to be taking the franchise in a bit of a different direction. They're darker, less utopian, which some people like, but they're also less socially charged, I feel. So they're still good. They're a little bit different from what we're used to.
They don't point out what a horrible world we live in anymore.
They make us feel a little bit better by showing us that the future isn't quite as shiny. Well, no, it's just as shiny because in the new future, everything's made of Teflon.
But, and there's nothing but lens flares.
Yeah. But people still have problems, so that makes us feel a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do appreciate that about it, but I did kind of like the utopian ideal and the escapism. Yeah.
But the new movies are definitely lacking nuclear vessels.
Yes. Victor 7. But going with the theme of change, Doctor Who has had more facelifts than Joan Rivers. And its current popularity is even more widespread, especially in the States. This is one of those shows that can be charming and delightful 1 minute, then horrifying and intense the next.
Just like you.
Exactly. I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me, Alex.
Shut up, Ed.
The staying power of the show comes directly from the titular character. Go ahead, laugh.
Nope.
No.
No.
We're above that sort of humor here on Ragnarok, Ed.
Yeah.
Titular sounds like tits.
Boner.
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 That's a good one.
Yeah.
So the titular character is the Doctor. And he's in a constant state of flux. He's brilliant, absent-minded, oblivious, charming, dashing, awkward, obnoxious, terrifying, darkly disturbed, mischievous. There's more than one way to pronounce that word, and I didn't get any of them. He's irreverent, he's cold, caring, and a whole bunch of other characteristics you wouldn't think go together, but they do.
You want to throw any other adjectives at us while you're at it?
Yeah.
I had to stop myself. There's a lot. I mean,
there are a lot of adjectives.
Yeah, I had to duct tape Ed's thesaurus shut.
But really, Alex, can you disagree with any of those adjectives?
Well, I don't know what mischievous means.
Other than mischievous,
it means mischievous.
Anyway, but these adjectives do all go together. And though each Doctor is different, he always has that same doctorosity to him that makes the show work.
You couldn't have gone with Doctor-ness?
No.
Okay.
See, this is why I shouldn't have duct taped Ed's thesaurus shut, because now he's making up words.
See, Ryan, you can tell exactly the point where you duct taped it shut. It's where he came up with doctorosity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that all of these shows in their own way have impacted sci-fi culture greatly. And, you know, obviously have had a big impact on us.
What are you talking about? I've never seen Star Trek before.
Or Doctor Who.
Nope.
And I especially don't watch the Time Tunnel.
Oh, no, I'm all about the Lost in Space.
What about Alex has never heard of anything but the Irwin Allen series, from what I just spoke about.
No wonder why he's so bitter.
Hey, I'm just channeling my Dr. Smith sometimes.
Anyway, so thank you for talking about sci-fi and television, Ed. Alex has an interesting subject to cover for us. He's going to be talking about the James Bond series.
All right, you were both doing that at the same time, and it sounded awful.
Well, that's because mine would have been better, but Ed ruined it.
That's true. And thank you for that very schoolmarm introduction there, Ryan. All right, now I'm going to read my essay. It's pretty hard to imagine that people listening haven't seen at least one James Bond movie. But the character James Bond was created in 1953 by the British author Ian Fleming, and he has become the world's quintessential spy. Now, the first novel featuring James Bond was Casino Royale. The character made his big screen debut, though, in 1962 in the movie Dr. No, starring Sean Connery and produced by Albert R. Broccoli, which the two of them sort of became the face of the series. If you mention Albert R. Broccoli, people either think of the vegetable or James Bond.
I think of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Well, you're stupid.
I think of broccoli and the vegetable.
Ed, stop talking. The series of films has been incredibly successful. People love James Bond. It's the second highest grossing film franchise of all time, earning $5.1 billion over the years. And it's beaten only by the Harry Potter franchise, which was around $7 billion in earnings. Now, six different actors have portrayed Bond over the decades, because people don't really want to see Sean Connery still playing Bond now. His adventures in the nursing home aren't quite as exciting.
I'm very old.
Though you'd be surprised. There are some, like, old-timers who are like, Sean Connery could still play Bond. What is this Pierce Brosnan nonsense?
Pierce Brosnan? Anyway. Six different actors have portrayed Bond over the years, but the formula has remained largely the same until they rebooted the series back in 2006 with Casino Royale. Fleming himself actually published 13 Bond novels, all of which were turned into films, and those came out from 1953 to 1966. The last two novels were published posthumously after his death. And then in the 80s, the novels were revived by other authors, and 28 more books were published from 81 to 2002. And I actually read some of those.
It would be weird to have a book published posthumously before your death, Alex.
It would. And I've actually read some of those newer Bond books, and they're pretty good, although none of them have been made into movies. And after 2002, those novels were followed by a short series of young Bond novels, which I could imagine being very good. And those were in turn followed by The Moneypenny Diaries, which chronicle the life of M's secretary, Miss Moneypenny.
Oh, dear.
I couldn't imagine being any good at all.
Just chapter after chapter of getting hit on by spies.
And don't forget about filing and typing.
Mm.
Fielding calls from agents.
And then she just goes home and vigorously masturbates.
While thinking, well, no, she doesn't have to go home for that. She has the whole VR chamber that Q designed, remember?
That's true.
Yeah. Now, the Bond franchise established itself with character archetypes that became staples for the genre. There was the dashing and roguish James Bond, who's Agent 007, and his boss, codenamed M, is the head of MI6, which is the British Foreign Intelligence, kind of like the CIA. Before M gives Bond a mission, though, to go do whatever he's supposed to do, Bond flirts with M's secretary, Miss Moneypenny, like we already said. Then he goes downstairs and gets his trademark gadgets from Q down in Q Division. And usually this is the biggest moment of levity in any Bond movie, because Desmond Lowell played Q hilariously for 30, maybe even 40 years.
Desmond Llewellyn.
Desmond Llewellyn, yes.
Then John Cleese.
Q John Cleese for two rather unfortunate movies.
Yeah.
And Bond's outfit from Q Division always includes a watch and a really gorgeous car that sometimes, more often than not, gets destroyed, which is a real shame. But it's a nice car.
Oh, yeah.
Then Bond goes off on his mission, seduces and sleeps with a gorgeous woman, foils the plans.
Who does not get destroyed?
What?
Who does not get destroyed?
Well, no, the first one does, usually.
Yeah, sometimes they get destroyed.
And then he foils the plans of an egomaniacal and larger-than-life villain, and then he beds another beautiful woman who doesn't get destroyed. And you repeat that 22 times, and you've got the James Bond franchise. But people like it because, you know, if the $5.1 billion that the movie series alone earned over the years doesn't prove that, that it's had a lasting impact, I don't know what will.
People love seeing explosions and sex.
It's true. Perhaps the fact that the Bond novels also, you know, have been adapted for television, radio, comics, and video games, the shows that people still want James Bond. And there's another movie in the way coming out either later this year or next year, another Daniel Craig film. The blend of action, women, gadgets, and, yes, a little bit of cheese and camp is a blend that no other series has really been able to replicate, only copy. I mean, Bond has influenced nearly every spy story since the movies came out. Even if you look at something like the Jason Bourne books and movies, the influence of Bond is there, if only because Jason Bourne is trying so desperately hard to not be James Bond. You know, and people will joke about it. If you think about it, Bond is actually, like, the worst spy in the world. Because everywhere he goes, he just blows shit up and makes a huge spectacle of everything. Which is not exactly what a covert operation is. But people still love it. And, you know, Daniel Craig, I think he's doing a great job.
He's true.
I want them to bring back George Lazenby. I thought he was...
I don't think that's going to happen.
He was my favorite, George Lazenby.
Well, you're welcome to enjoy OHMSS, Ed. And the rest of us will move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everyone has their favorite James Bond.
George Lazenby.
Well, we know Ed's.
Yeah.
I mean, normally I would say Sean Connery, but I'm really liking Daniel Craig. I think he's edging out Sean Connery. Even though Quantum of Solace wasn't very good. Mm. Casino Royale was fantastic.
Yes, it was.
I would have said Pierce Brosnan, but, you know, then The World Is Not Enough happened.
And Die Another Day. Die Another Day was even worse.
The World Is Not Enough wasn't as bad.
No.
Die Another Day was awful.
I mean, in Die Another Day, Bond drove an invisible car through an ice palace and then dropped a chandelier on a guy who had diamonds embedded in his face.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Die Another Day or was it The World Is Not Enough where he used the line, I thought Christmas only comes once a year?
Oh, no, that was World Is Not Enough.
Yeah, that was the moment that that just turned the series for me because that was so bad.
Well, Denise Richards was playing a character who for some reason was named Christmas because apparently her parents hated her from birth.
Yes, I understand. I understand, and that's what made me hate it.
I can understand that.
There were jokes that were just as bad or worse in previous movies. Like, I believe in GoldenEye, Moneypenny. Oh no, it was Tomorrow Never Dies. Moneypenny refers to James as a cunning linguist.
There was also the one back from, I think it was Roger Moore's. I don't remember which one had the female spy Goodnight. Maybe it was Moonraker.
No, that was Man with a Golden Gun.
Okay. And at the end, they're in the escape pod or something, floating in the sea, and M calls them up, and he's asking for Agent Goodnight. And he's like, Goodnight, Goodnight! And of course, Bond is in bed, like, mid-coitus with her when he calls, and Bond just picks up the phone and goes, Goodnight, sir, and hangs up the phone.
Please, there were characters called Pussy Galore and Dr. Goodhead.
And Octopussy. Don't forget Octopussy.
It's true.
And what was Goldfinger's real name?
Auric Goldfinger.
Oh, Auric. Because that's just gold again. Mm. Yeah, so Bond has always been cheesy. So don't hang the, I thought Christmas only comes once a year, is the one thing that made you hate it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Well.
Speaking of long-lived things, Meyer, how's that boner doing?
It's still being a boner.
Do we need to get the fluffer in here?
Nope. Well,
it hasn't been 4 hours yet.
Ah.
And the fluffer would only make the boner worse.
Yeah, that's true. Wait, I thought we wanted the boner to last.
I'm actually sitting next to him, and I really don't want it to.
Oh, okay.
Really, I'm not even in the same area, and I don't want any more to do with this boner.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't we talk about Lord of the Rings, then?
Oh, yes. Lord of the Rings.
That's well, now I have a boner.
Yeah, that's not going to get rid of Meyer's boner, Ryan.
Lord of the Cock Rings?
That's also not going to get rid of Meyer's boner. Mm. Again, that just making it worse.
But anyway. So, Lord of the Rings is good.
All right, moving on to Ryan.
So, in 1954, J.R.R. Tolkien, he released the first novel in his fantasy trilogy. It was called The Lord of the Rings, and people know this. So, when he started writing the script, it was only supposed to be a sequel to his previous book, The Hobbit, which was a children's novel. But throughout writing it, which was during most of World War II, it developed into a huge piece of work that was much more mature and much darker than what The Hobbit was. And when I say huge, I mean it was huge.
No, Maya, we're talking about the books, not your boner.
That's also... Well, I don't want to give high expectations to ladies out there. It's very average size.
Meyer doesn't want to disappoint anyone.
It's adequate.
It is adequate. It does what it has to do.
Okay. It's of a serviceable length and girth.
Serviceable. Good word.
That's what
I don't like this episode at all.
Excuse me. You have a serviceable penis.
Come on, Ed. Stop being so homophobic and learn to love Meyer's boner.
So, and the novels were split into 6 books, 2 of them per novel, per volume, with several appendices of background material included at the end of the 3rd volume.
Oh, yeah.
It's the beast. It's because Tolkien is a smart guy. He was really smart. And it was really comprehensive.
He was also a cunning linguist.
Hey-o!
Oh, yes, he was. So, and you know, he created a whole fucking world. You know, and, you know, it's complete with races and backstory and various languages, both written and spoken.
Yeah, Elvish is a full-on language.
And there's Dwarvish. Tolkien, as Ryan was saying, he's a language nerd.
Philologist.
He was a philologist, after all. And he was an Oxford professor. That's how you know someone's smart.
Yeah, that's one way.
But, so, you know, I mean, he was even in the process of writing the Silmarillion before he died, which was a novel about the history of Middle-earth.
It was more of a textbook than a novel.
Well, as I said, he was comprehensive. And
yes.
Very comprehensive.
And, you know, his creativity is remarkable. It's like, think about, like, all this stuff he's created. It's like, oh, how can you do that? It's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel, you know, that's why so many people enjoyed Lord of the Rings, because, you know, Middle Earth feels like an actual place because he took so much work into all the details in this world. And, you know, I'm sure that young kids reading The Hobbit or stoners actually believed it was a real place and it actually existed at some point in time.
It didn't?
No. And, you know, because it's so big and epic, it has become the subject of, you know, extensive analysis, you know, of its themes and origins, like it's everything. I mean, college kids have written their thesis papers about Lord of the Rings, and, you know, English scholars have written hundreds of papers on, you know, every fine detail about it.
My sister has her wedding ring engraved in Elvish.
I see.
The inside, it says something in Elvish.
Is it spoken by Legolas?
Well, I mean, it's an engravement, so nobody really speaks it.
I don't like that, then.
Does it say something about one ring to bind Larry?
Yes. One ring to bind Larry.
You know, it's Lord of the Rings is a literary achievement.
Yep.
And it was at the time, and it still is, an immensely popular book. I mean, it's the third most popular novel ever written, selling over 150 million copies.
Just after the Bible. Hey-o!
You know, I did once see somebody in a book. No, Chuck. Chuck actually told me this story. He saw somebody in a bookstore looking at a copy of the book, and obviously it had the picture of the movie on it, because that's what they do now. And they said, where did they get all these extra scenes from? It wasn't in the movie.
That's true, except it wasn't a bookstore. It was when he was at Comic-Con waiting to have someone sign his copy.
Oh, it was at Comic-Con.
Waiting online, yeah.
Either way, I believe Chuck's reaction was to fire lightning bolts from his hand and end the person's existence right then and there.
Yes, yeah, yes, that's that part of it. Yes.
I think is the right reaction. Accurate.
Yeah,
that
sounds like Chuck. That was, yeah.
So, you know, as for the impact of Lord of the Rings, I mean, I think everything fantasy related has come out after Lord of the Rings is in some way influenced by it. I mean, words like Tolkienian, Tolkienian, and Tolkien-esque have been recorded in the Oxford Dictionary. And you know, Lord of the Rings has influenced, inspired, you know, artwork and music, films, television, video games.
Did you ever hear about those movies they made about it? Came out a few years ago?
Well, yeah. No, I didn't.
It was like,
but you know what? You know, my favorite pop culture reference, Alex, to Middle Earth,
mm-hmm.
gotta be the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
Oh, by Leonard Nimoy. It's genius.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, Lord of the Rings has had a huge impact on pop culture. I mean, Frodo Lives was a popular counterculture slogan in the 60s and 70s. You see it's spray painted on walls and people had shirts on, the hippie bastards there.
I don't understand why that's a counterculture slogan, but okay.
I don't know. I think it was a counterculture thing. It was because a lot of hippies and stuff.
Because they're hippies. They just say things and they think it's counterculture.
Oh, like hipsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hippies.
Hipsters.
Yeah, but you know what? Frodo Lives, nothing compared to Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. That was just, that's high art.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been many adaptions of Lord of the Rings for radio and theater, as well as those award-winning films you mentioned.
They won awards?
I believe the last one won 12 Oscars.
They were directed by a man I like to call Jack Peterson.
That sounds accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Lord of the Rings, in closing, I would say, is one of the most, one of the timeless pieces of literature, that is. And it's always going to be popular and will always continue to inspire people. And that's what I have to say about that.
You also have to consider, too.
That's all I have to say about it.
You also have to consider, too, that Middle Earth, stripped of its copyrightable material, is also pretty much now the default setting for any fantasy RPG.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tolkien pretty much created the fantasy genre. Elves and dwarves and everything.
Yeah, our whole modern idea of what a fantasy setting is.
I remember, people, you know, say, you know, Dungeons and Dragons was influenced by Lord of the Rings. And the guy the lead designer or something, I forgot his name, but he was like, nope, no it wasn't. I was like, you're a liar. Dungeons and Dragons is obviously inspired by Lord of the Rings.
He just doesn't want the estate of J.R.R. Tolkien to sue him into oblivion.
Yeah.
Now, just so all you listeners don't think we forgot about it, Eric was going to talk about the Silver Age of comics, but he's off dealing with whatever we decided at the beginning of the show was keeping him from being here. The
Genophage.
No, it wasn't the Genophage. That's correct.
Maybe it was Tribbles?
It was the Tylaxian flu.
Right, right.
Tylaxian plague.
Right.
That's why Eric's not here.
Eric is
not a Krogan. No, he's not.
So Eric, yeah, Eric is. Uh,
Eric,
beige or something.
He has a beard. And it's not
so good. Maybe he'll be kind enough to write us something for the website about the Silver Age of comics.
And
but
probably
until
not.
Such a time, we're gonna bide our time waiting the great long while that it'll take Eric to do that. Ryan, why don't you talk to us about some things?
All right. Well, Ed covered sci-fi TV. I figured I might as well cover the developments in sci-fi film.
Oh, that's very thoughtful.
How kind of you. How kind of you, Ryan.
Hi.
You are the yin to my yang.
Yes. The big budget, well, not always big budget counterpart to your low budget counterpart. Sometimes, in fact, quite a bit of sci-fi film from the 1950s was pretty much relegated to the status of B films. Science fiction in film in the 1950s was kind of an uneasy combination of the awful and the sublime. The standout examples that I can think of are usually notable for being either ingenious pieces of cinema or the corniest kind of camp that it's possible to make. Take, for instance, the brilliant film Forbidden Planet, which explores the relationship between a man and his subconscious through his interaction with the lost technology of an alien species. It's got a really gripping plot that was ripped off from Shakespeare. It's got fantastic set designs and really great special effects by MGM. You know, so some of the biggest budget movies came out of that studio, and they wanted to make Forbidden Planet the first sci-fi A film. Mm. And of all people, Leslie Nielsen starring as the lead.
Wow. He actually was quite a dramatic actor for. That's why, like, he wasn't a comedic actor until
Airplane.
They cast him because he was so stone faced. And
well, he was playing the straight guy on that one too, pretty much. Well,
yeah, I mean that movie was actually cast with a lot of straight man actors.
Yeah.
What's his name? The main guy who plays Ted, I forget.
The mom of Partridge Family?
Robert Hayes.
Also, and the guy from Mission Impossible, Peter Graves, was in it. And they were all, you know, these stone-faced dramatic actors. But we're not talking about Airplane.
No, we're not. So stop it.
So you've got, you know, Forbidden Planet with all this wonderful stuff happening. And then, you know, from the opposite side of the spectrum, another one of my corny favorites, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, which is a stellar example of a B-movie that was churned out by an out-of-work actor cum screenwriter, as I like to imagine it, over a long weekend during a nasty binge on cheap whiskey.
Ryan also likes to jerk off when imagining Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
It's true, I do.
Why would he have to imagine it? Why wouldn't he just watch it?
I'll get to that.
You imagine yourself watching it?
when I picture myself watching this movie, it just sends me off into flights of ecstasy. But the reason that I like to imagine that this is what was going on with the writer is just because the dialogue is so terrible. The filmmakers couldn't even afford a shoestring special effects budget. And the director was so embarrassed by the final product that he used a fake name in the credits. So as I said earlier, a lot of the films in the 50s, sci-fi films in the 50s were sort of indicative of this dichotomy. They were either really amazing or really terrible. From expertly crafted epics like The Day the Earth Stood Still to creature features like The Blob and Creature from the Black Lagoon, science fiction of the 50s brought us the best and the worst of the genre. In the 60s, this trend kind of continued. One of my favorites is Village of the Damned, which is a low-budget English horror film about a group of alien-born blonde children who can kill with their collective glowing eye powers. La Jetée, which is an experimental French short that would eventually inspire 12 Monkeys, came out during the early 60s as well, and that told the story of a time traveler desperate to prevent a world-changing disaster. It told the story entirely in still frames.
I've actually seen that one. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it is a really amazing movie, and I can understand why Terry Gilliam used it as source material.
Yeah.
The most notable sci-fi film of this period is, of course, 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is Stanley Kubrick's masterwork produced in collaboration with Arthur C. Clarke.
Who we talked about last time.
We did. And I think we even mentioned this film, but yeah. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it. I mean, who but Kubrick and Clark could tell a story spanning the entirety of human existence with such a balletic style? The film is mostly free of dialogue, but its imagery is striking even today. It is probably the original drug trip film because of the ending sequence. The bit with the Stargate and Dave Bowman turning into a baby.
And then Richard Dean Anderson. The Stargate.
Yeah. And the mullet. No.
Val Kilmer?
No, we're not talking about MacGyver. We're talking about Stargate.
Val
Richard
Kilmer.
Dean Anderson.
It was
okay.
A movie.
No, it wasn't.
So moving into the 70s.
Kurt Russell.
Did you just get Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell confused?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just the blood is all in his penis.
Wait, are you really? You're really gonna? I just got Irwin.
That's true.
Irwin Allen and Steve Irwin mixed up.
At least they both had the Irwin.
Whatever.
Okay, continue. It would have been a very different movie with Val Kilmer playing O'Neill.
Why? Why is he so much different than Kurt Russell?
Val Kilmer isn't. Kurt Russell's like very gruff. Val Kilmer isn't that gruff.
He was Batman.
He was a crappy Batman.
Well, still, you know. I could see Val Kilmer pulling it off.
He could have brought some of his real genius attitude to...
Although Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, really good movie.
Yes, it was.
Anyway.
Yeah, so moving into the early 1970s...
Before we continue talking about Val Kilmer's film.
That was a period of experimentation in filmmaking, an observation which applies to the sci-fi genre as well. As most film geeks know... The 70s is known as the Hollywood Renaissance because a lot of the studios had collapsed, and rather than this incredibly huge movie-producing machine, Hollywood started focusing on individual directors, and that sort of thing happened in sci-fi as well. As in the decades before, these movies hewed closely to either brilliance or ridiculousness. Compare, for instance, the Russian masterwork Solaris and the cinematic enigma that is Zardoz.
Zardoz.
One is a deeply troubling inquiry into human loss, while the other presents the viewer with an absurd onslaught of images and sounds.
I don't know.
Zardoz is deeply troubling.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah, it is.
Look at what Sean Connery had to wear.
Yeah, it was his first post-Bond movie, too. He's like, I just finished one of the most successful film franchises of all time. Yeah. I'm gonna film Zardoz. Yeah.
And you gotta figure too, that bit with the stone head vomiting guns and yelling about the penis, that had to happen fairly early in the script. So he got through that whole thing without saying to himself, "Wow, this is a bad decision."
You know what they probably did? They probably didn't give him that part until he already agreed to do it and showed up on set. Be like, oh, they wrote this new scene. We're going to film it real quick. Here you go.
I don't know what the fuck is this? I don't know what you guys are talking about. If I read that in the script, I'd be like, all right, let's make this fucking movie.
Zardoz would not like you right now.
Yeah.
The penis is evil.
Yeah.
Of course, George Lucas got his start in this period as well. He made his USC thesis film into a feature, and that was THX 1138 with Robert Duvall.
And Val Kilmer.
And Steve Irwin.
When
Irwin.
Is the special edition of THX 1138 coming out?
Oh, they have to release it in 3D first.
So how do these films hold up today? Well, even the good films seem a little campy by today's standards, and the campy films drop completely into the realm of the laughable. But many of the sci-fi films of this era are still considered classics. I mean, who isn't awestruck by the stunning space vistas of 2001 set to the Blue Danube, or completely confused, but in a good way, by the ending sequence with the Star Child, as I mentioned before?
Val Kilmer.
I am not.
And Val Kilmer isn't either.
Oh, really? What's so bad about Val Kilmer?
Alex is honing in on this joke, and he's going to insert
Val Kilmer into everything for the rest of the episode.
You hate Val Kilmer as much as Ed hates Irwin Allen.
I actually
Irwin
like
Allen.
Val Kilmer. I don't have anything against him.
Well, anyway,
other than Batman
so,
Forever.
So you got that whole sequence at the end of 2001, and then, how can you not laugh out loud at the see-through giant lady in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, or the giant stone head decrying the evils of the penis in Zardoz?
Oh, God.
For good or ill, science fiction films of the third quarter of the 20th century have stuck with us and continue to inspire reimaginings and homages to this day.
Because Hollywood is out of original ideas.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
You know, only Val Kilmer can save us.
I was going to say, you know who's not out of original ideas?
Val Kilmer.
Val fucking Kilmer. All right, well, that concludes our third retrospective. I hope you all are ready for the fourth one. I don't think they know what it's going to be. Should we tell them?
No, don't tell them. Let them be surprised. No, don't tell them.
Okay.
No, don't tell them. Okay, don't tell them.
Okay, it's going to be Geek Century Part 4 from 1976 to the present.
No, wait, don't tell them.
Too late, Ed. I already did.
Damn it.
We can right. Bleep it out.
Well, you know what? We're going to go to break, and maybe during the interlude they'll forget.
Boner!
Oh, yeah, we're going to have to deal with that, too. So we'll be right back after this.
All right, does anybody have anything that, like a match? Or I hear if you put a match against it, it'll go away.
Actually, when it goes on that long, you just have to stick a needle in and drain the blood.
I don't like any of these ideas about my penis.
A match, really?
Yeah.
Welcome back. We consulted our good friend and scientist Val Kilmer, and we drained all the blood from Meyer's penis. So things are back to normal. How you feeling, Meyer?
I don't like my penis anymore.
Meyer, you still have a leech kind of like hanging off.
Stop looking at my penis.
Well, put it away.
We're going to nickname the leech Val Kilmer and keep it as a pet.
It's too sore right now.
Okay, all right. Just no one touch Meyer's penis. Anyway,
done.
It's easier for you, Ed. You're not here.
If I was there, I would just be drawn to it. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You just have the unconquerable urge to reach over and give Meyer a handy.
Anyway, before we move on to our next segment, we have a little announcement we want to make for all of our listeners at Ragnarok. We know how much you love listening to our bi-weekly podcasts, but we've all sat together and talked and made a decision that we're going to be switching the podcast to a quad-weekly format.
Otherwise known as monthly.
Well, we're going to do it every 4 weeks, which would actually be 13 times a year instead of 12.
Right.
And, you know, we're doing this because as the months have gone on, we've gotten more accustomed to doing this, but things have been getting to change for all of us here at Ragnarok, and it sort of makes the bi-weekly schedule a lot less doable. So by switching to the monthly release, we're hoping that we can make sure we can still keep doing this podcast and bringing you the quote-unquote quality entertainment that you listen to us for. But we're not just going to leave you hanging for the rest of the month. What we've decided to do is, because it seems to be popular with folks, we're going to fill those intervening weeks with actual plays of role-playing scenarios that we do. Because we do love to roll dice and just sort of make a mess of everything while we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured recording those and posting those online could be a good and entertaining way to fill the gap between episodes.
And we've already started. I put the first part of Bad Blood, which is a Call of Cthulhu scenario that I ran a couple of weeks back.
Yeah.
I put that online. Look for part two in the weeks to come.
Yeah, and that's good stuff, so you should definitely check that out. So just so you all understand, we're going to finish with the Geek Century. So in 2 weeks, there will be another episode of Ragnarok where we do Geek Century Part 4. And then after that, we're going to switch to our new monthly format. So it'll be 4 weeks from
we'll
Geek Century.
We'll ease you into it. Don't worry. We're not heartless.
Yes. So you'll have 2 weeks from now, regularly scheduled episode of Ragnarok. And then 2 weeks after that, there will be an actual play. And then 2 weeks after that, AP will be episode 20 of Ragnar Rock. So, if you know, we hope you're all okay with that. If you're not, let us know, and maybe you can persuade us to change. You can't, but you can try futility.
You know what I miss? I miss episode 8.
Futility.
Episode 8 was a great episode.
It was, until Eric ruined it.
Yeah, Eric fucked it up.
Yeah, he does that. But maybe if they get Val Kilmer, we might do it bi-weekly again.
Well, I mean, Val Kilmer would just do the whole thing himself, pretty much.
Probably.
I mean, it is Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
It's nothing the man can't do.
Yeah.
Except play Batman. So anyway, along the spirit of the actual plays, this next segment that we're going to do is sort of like when we had the idea for the webcomic.
That never happened.
Yeah. Hasn't happened yet.
Hasn't happened yet. Okay.
It's called I'll Play That.
It's on hiatus.
I like your optimistic tone.
Yeah. Anyway, this segment is called I'd Play That. And we've all come up with a pitch for a one-shot, maybe, you know, if it goes a little long, a two-game scenario for different systems that we have played or have been meaning to play. And we're all going to pitch them to you, the listeners, and then we're going to have a poll up on the website again, and you can all vote for them. And then we'll play the scenario and record it, and that will be one of the actual plays that we do.
Hopefully more than 3 people will vote this time.
Maybe we can get 4.
That'd be nice.
That'll be like a 33% increase in voter turnout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a low point, the comics.
Yeah, that was a low point. But we have more listeners now, and hopefully people like us more.
Yeah.
So, come out.
There was that one guy on Facebook who said that we should play more drunken board games.
It could happen if people come out and vote.
Definitely.
Yeah. So we're each going to present our ideas.
In fact, my presentation is just Monopoly.
No. No one vote for it.
Nobody likes to play with that.
Yeah.
I want to roll up the stats for the car.
Oh, I call the battleship.
You're going to win.
Yeah.
You're our combat tweak.
I'm the tank.
I want to be the doggy.
You would want to be the doggy.
Speaking of battleship, during that football game that happened, did everybody see the preview for Battleship?
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Most of us watched it together, Ed. We were there with you.
With Liam Neeson doing his signature American accent.
And Rihanna's in it, too.
Yes, she is.
I didn't know that. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Come on, Ryan. You didn't know this was going to be Rihanna's big screen debut?
No. Why? Why would anyone choose that?
Because she's good looking.
Yep. She is. She is good looking.
Yep.
She's a very talented singer, but why Battleship?
I want you to fire the missiles at location B6.
Well, Ryan, think of it this way. It can't be any worse because Rihanna's in it.
No, you're right.
I mean, we've got Rihanna, we've got Leslie Nielsen, Liam Neeson.
We're just fucking up names left and right tonight.
Leslie Nielsen and Liam Neeson.
Ted, get your stuff together.
Sorry.
All right, so before we piss off Val Kilmer anymore, let's get into our I'd Play That scenario. So I'm going to go first. This is my idea.
Okay.
I came up with a wild talent scenario. And for those of you who don't know, Wild Talents is a superhero RPG. Put plainly, superheroes and stuff. So the idea I had is set during World War II, probably roundabouts April 1943. And all the players are part of a small allied task force of Wild Talents. And the Wild Talents are what they call people who have superpowers. And now I'm pretty sure from having looked through the book, they have a whole alternate history set up. The Wild Talents are still kind of rare during World War II. That's like when they're starting to, you know, be birthed, more or less. So this is when people are starting to develop powers. So there's a small group of Wild Talents. And the Allies get intelligence that the Germans have talents of their own, obviously. But not only that, one of them is able to harness the power of the atom. Pretty much, he's a walking nuke. And this has the higher-ups in the American Army quite nervous because they know of the destructive power of atomics from the work that's being done on the Manhattan Project. So they also get word that the Germans' plan is to sneak this atomic wild talent into London and have him detonate himself. And then from there, he would travel to Washington, D.C. and do the same thing, which would effectively cripple the Allies and secure a German victory in World War II. And obviously, the Allies don't want that. So, it is the job of the party, who are Wild Talents, to find this German wild talent, most likely by sneaking across enemy lines and stopping him by any means necessary. Mm. So he might be willfully doing it. He might be doing it against his will, and you could sort of rescue him. You know, that remains to be seen. But that's the idea. You'd have to sneak into Germany or occupied places, find this guy, and stop him.
And, of course, we would all have really awesome superpowers.
Of course. Or, like, mech armor.
Hmm. Could I stop him sexually?
Maybe.
Nice.
Maybe he just needs some sexual healing.
Well, my boner is back now.
Oh,
man.
Why, we're just going to have to get the leeches again.
Yeah. I just finished putting them away, too.
All right, Meyer, think of...
Rihanna, boner is in full boner.
Okay, think of Eliza Dushku.
Over my boner.
All right, that took care of his boner. All right, Meyer, why don't you distract yourself by telling us your idea? Maybe that'll get rid of your
boner. Well, wait, doesn't Ed go first?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. On the notes we have, Ed's idea is somewhat easy to gloss over. So, Ed, why don't you tell us your proposition?
All right, so the game that I've come up with is actually a scenario for an original game. It's an original game base that I am coming up with. And essentially, the game takes place in an insane asylum, which is actually more of a metaphor for Limbo. So basically, in the story, the characters are all strangers, seemingly unrelated strangers, who wake up in an insane asylum as patients, and they're told that they're dead and that they're in limbo. So it's not a mystery of figuring out why they're there. They're in limbo.
Okay.
Like a video game?
Yes, exactly.
I'm a small boy.
In order to pass over to their final reward, they must come to terms with all of their personal demons. As a catalyst for change, the hospital administrator, Dr. Alghieri, asks for their help to solve a rash of murders. Murders being dead souls that are destroyed before they have a chance to complete their tasks. Players get to choose their objectives beforehand that they must complete to pass over. So in character creation, you would actually choose basically, what unfinished business did you have before you died? You know, did you have some sort of vengeance? Did you have some sort of task that you didn't complete? Things like that that you need to come up with beforehand that become part of your character. You have all the attributes you had as mortals, plus a specific power over an energy. There are three energies. There's mental energy, there's physical substance, and then the third energy in the triad is the energy of spirit. So you would basically create these characters, and they are X people, and through the game, you would have to not only come to terms with your demon and complete your individual tasks, but then also, in this case, solve the murders that you are tasked with solving. So before you can pass over, you need to solve your own problems and the task assigned to you.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
My first question is, you say your goal is to pass over into your final reward. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of risk that you could go the other way and go to hell?
Well, that's sort of like what happens if you get destroyed before you complete your tasks.
Okay, so you end up in hell.
So ghosts can die? That sucks.
Well,
Super death!
Essentially, the setting is going to be pretty much like your people.
Except...
You're saying ghosts aren't people?
Yeah, the form that you're in, you look like humans, you talk like humans, you can get killed by, I guess they're limbo guns. They're not actual guns, but they have the form of guns.
Or heaven guns.
Heaven guns.
Right.
Does heaven guns kill anything?
Basically, everything manifests itself in human terms. So even though you're not necessarily actually being shot with a real gun, it manifests itself as you getting shot with a gun and dying.
That's how we perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So you can die. You're not any more powerful. I mean, you're a little more powerful because you have control over the energies. But you aren't any more powerful or, you know, you're just as fragile as you were when you were a human. And if you're destroyed before you complete your tasks, you end up in hell or oblivion.
Okay.
All right. Cool.
All right. And my second question is, this sounds a lot more like a campaign than a one shot. Did you intend to do all of this in one game, or was it?
Well, this is a setup that could take one game or more games. This particular setup, I think, if we make the characters a little more minimal.
Mm-hmm. And make it,
for instance,
make it a murder instead of a series of murders, or okay.
Well, even if you're solving a series of murders, you know what I mean by
be a serial killer who killed all of us.
Yeah,
right. It's one person. Gotcha. You know, for this particular the single task you go on is not going to be hard to
complete. Would be to catch a
murder. That'll be a one shot. As far as your own personal goals, that could take a long time. That could take a short amount of time. It depends on what goals you set for yourself. Part of the game system is that you can take multiple tasks, and essentially that'll affect your outcome will be more the more tasks you have to complete, the more positive your outcome will be in the end.
Okay, so you'll get to a better heaven.
Yeah. But the
more it's a caste system, heaven.
But the more tasks you have, and also the longer you'll be able to stay in the game, and the longer you'll be able to contribute. But the more tasks you have, obviously, the harder it is to complete them.
Right.
I am of the take one task, peace fuckers, I'm out to heaven scenario.
Yeah, I mean, even the crappy part of heaven is still heaven.
It's true. Right. It's still paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I suppose that would depend on your play style and whether it was going to be a one shot or a campaign.
Yeah.
In this situation with the campaign, you might only want to take one.
I used to work with a Mormon guy, and he said that he thinks that he feels that I would go to heaven, but not the heaven he would go to. He would go to better heaven.
He goes to a gated community heaven?
Yeah.
He's up on the hill in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
He would go to the better heaven than I.
You live in the trailer park heaven.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay, because my heaven, I'm Pastafarian, so my heaven has a stripper factory and a beer volcano.
Ooh.
It's better than all the other heavens.
That's pretty awesome, yeah.
It's a pretty good heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I just decided I'm not going to heaven.
Can I go to limbo?
Yeah.
No. You do only have one eye, Ryan, so, you know.
Ryan's just going to chill at the insane asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to go party with Val Kilmer in Pastafarian heaven.
Well, my game is not based on heaven or anything like that.
Good.
I decided to run a game based on White Wolf's game, Adventure. And you know what kind of game that is?
What kind?
It's a romantic comedy.
Ooh, I like it.
Well, that was a joke. A crappy joke. It's an adventure game because it's called Adventure.
I'd rather play the romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, you should have really.
Can you spin it to us as a romantic comedy?
Can Ryan and I play Star-Crossed Lovers?
Anyway, continue.
You are in love.
let's put Meyer back on the rails.
Well, anyway, so the plot is that, that you guys be playing adventurers who are in love with one another, but you're friends with benefits.
Okay. All right.
Butt buddies.
Who not only will you be going on your first adventure together, but it's your first time teaming up with one another. And shenanigans ensue.
Wait, what did you just... Did you just say it's not only our first time teaming up together?
No, your first adventure you're going on.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's your first adventure, and you're teaming up with these people that you never teamed up with before.
Okay, I gotcha.
And shenanigans... This is a standard romantic comedy.
So it's like Indiana Jones, but speed dating.
Yeah.
Come on, my the shenanigans.
Indiana Jones is Sleepless in Seattle.
Indiana Jones and You've Got Mail.
Mm-hmm.
So, the adventure.
When Indy met Lara.
What was the annoying one from Temple of Doom? I
forget her name.
I don't know. The Asian kid.
Short Round?
Yeah.
He wasn't the annoying one, it was the chick.
Short Round was
both annoying.
They were both annoying.
Come on, Dr. Jones!
Come on!
What's annoying about that?
Come on, Indy! So, the adventure that you guys will be going on would be to find an ancient sacred Colosseum that is, well, not a Colosseum. It's, it is, well, I'll say a Colosseum right now. It's an arena. Well, that's the same thing, though, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So it's hidden, but it's hidden in this, the middle of a dangerous and treacherous jungle, and you have to get there to attain a mystical axe that is said to give the wielder unknown powers. Ooh. Maybe the power of love and friendship.
The power of love.
That's the power of love.
So, I guess the question is, you're going to ask is, how are you gonna find the Colosseum and what powers the axe gives? Are you guys the only people looking for the axe? Will your teamwork work together? Will everyone make it? Well, I don't know these answers right now, but Will knows the answers. So if the viewers pick mine, I'm going to have to ask Will about these the answers and find them out.
Oh, what's a Colosseum?
I feel like I'm just going to go to Google Maps and type in Ancient Sacred Colosseum and see what comes up. That's how I'm going to find it.
Just look for the pin in the middle of the Amazon.
Exactly. Like, all right, guys, I left my browser up at home, so it should still be there as long as, like, the power doesn't go off, the computer doesn't start. Yeah,
I would also
relax. I'm the map.
All right, so...
So that was my game, and I hope you pick it, because if you don't, I'm going to show everyone my picture of my boner.
Vote Mayor Quimby. He'd vote for you.
Anyway, so my idea was I wanted to run a Monsters and Other Childish Things scenario. I came up with this idea a while ago, and I never really had the chance to flesh it out much, but I'd love the opportunity to dust it off and give it
a try. Was that the one that we took super seriously?
No. This is a different one that I had.
I was being sarcastic.
Is this the one with the tongue guy?
No.
The alien.
No, this is the one with
Imagination Will.
Imagination Will.
No. This is a different one. See, even that game I didn't really plan out too much, and I think that was the biggest problem with it. But this one I actually, you know, have some ideas for. For those of you who don't know, Monsters and Other Childish Things is a one role engine game. The premise of it is that all of the player characters play kids who have pet monsters or monster friends from another dimension. And I guess it could be anything from like a Lovecraftian Cthulhu-esque horror to, you know, like a giant teddy bear with horrible claws and, you know, soulless doll eyes, however you want to handle it. So the premise of my game is that the players are a group of kids. They have monster companions, obviously, and they all hang out in this treehouse in a privately owned park. They awake one morning to discover high fences and construction equipment surrounding their awesome headquarters, and they learn that a local businessman has plans to cut down the tree and raise the surrounding park so that his company can build a shopping mall on the land. So the player's goal would basically be to stop the nefarious real estate developer from destroying their clubhouse by any means necessary. So, you know, they can choose a direct approach, which might get them into epic monster versus construction equipment battles, which I think would be really awesome. You know, or they could treat it as more of a mystery and, you know, try to discredit him somehow, do a little bit of digging and, you know, possibly uncover the real reason why the company wants to take a chainsaw to their favorite tree. Ooh, mystery hook. Ooh. So, yeah, depending on how that goes, you know, that could either be a fun kind of, you know, beer and pretzels combat game, you know, or it could be maybe a little bit more of a mystery.
Or both.
Or a romantic comedy.
Well, we'll just ask Val Kilmer. All right, so those are our proposals, folks. Now, we're going to put a poll up on the site. You can vote there. But in case you don't want to do the old-fashioned clicking and polling thing, you can send us emails or leave us voicemails telling us which one you want. Or
anything else we'll say during the closing.
Yeah, or maybe even write in if you're old-fashioned and can figure out an address to send it to. Don't do that.
But just know hanging chads will be discounted.
No hanging chads. Also, really old joke, Ed.
Yeah. I was just thinking to myself, did Ed just make a 2000 election joke?
Well, you see, because Ed's been watching How I Met Your Mother, and the Hanging Chad is referenced.
Ah.
Yeah. That's where you got it from, right, Ed?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know Ed too well. All right, so we're going to be back after this with a little sketch that Ed wrote. Hopefully. You have it, right, Ed?
Let's go take a break.
Great.
That's encouraging.
Okay, Ed, it's time for the entertainment bit. Where's that sketch you wrote?
Guys, you're going to love this one. It's kind of out there, but it's really new and hip. I think it really speaks to the zeitgeist.
Oh, Jesus. What is it?
Okay, so keep an open mind, guys, because this sketch is so modern and so fresh, it doesn't even have a script.
You're fucking kidding me, right?
Nope. All it has is a name. It's called Ed Sketch.
Ed Sketch!
What the fuck was that?
Cool, right? It's part of the sketch. Anytime someone says, Ed Sketch...
Ed Sketch!
The narrator says it in a really cool voice.
The narrator? What the hell are you talking about? Where's that even coming from? Ed, are you a witch?
So let me get this straight. You haven't written a damn thing, but instead you've somehow managed to alter reality in such a way that a creepy, disembodied voice says, Ed Sketch...
Ed Sketch!
Every time we say, Ed Sketch...
Ed Sketch!
Genius, right?
That does sound like something you'd do.
Yeah.
So now what? We just sit around and wait for one of us to say Ed Sketch?
Ed Sketch!
Guys, please don't. This voice is really scaring the crap out of me.
Don't worry, Meyer. No one is going to say Ed Sketch.
Ed Sketch!
You bastard!
Ed Sketch! Ed Sketch! Ed Sketch!
Ed Sketch! Ed Sketch! Ed Sketch! Ed Sketch!
Stop it!
Great, Ed. See what you've done? Now Eric's being a giant dick and Meyer's crying. The podcast is ruined.
Guys, look. Can I make a suggestion? Instead of doing Ed Sketch...
Ed Sketch!
Meyer, sorry. Instead of doing that sketch, can we do one I came up with?
Anything is better than this crap.
Hey, I like to think of it as a Brechtian piece.
Sorry, Ed. All right, Eric, let's have it.
All right. Well, the sketch I came up with is called Nut Punch.
Nut Punch!
Yeah, so that was another episode of Ragnarok, Geek Century Part 3, or Bloodthirsty Revenants from Beyond the Moon.
Ugh. They just get a bad name, actually. They have a bad rep. They were actually very pleasant.
Well, I mean, they are just dead Australians, so.
And they don't judge someone who has a erect penis.
And, you know, they're not actually bloodthirsty, they're just Foster's thirsty.
Ah.
And their bloodthirstiness did take care of Meyer's erection.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
We did just have a bunch of dead Australians fillet Meyer.
Yeah, but there was a lot of biting involved.
Yeah, it's pretty horrible.
It's what I'm into.
Okay.
No judgments, buddy.
Not gonna judge.
Just like I'm into picturing myself watching Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah, exactly.
And Alex is into Val Kilmer.
Hey, who isn't?
Who isn't?
So, just to remind you all, because I know it's been like 10 minutes, but next episode is going to be our last bi-weekly episode, and then we're switching to our monthly format. So just stay on the lookout for that. And remember to vote for what you thought your favorite role-playing scenario was, so we can run that and record
pitch.
It. Your favorite pitch, if you will.
Vote for Eric's. It's blank.
I think Eric did the best one. Clearly,
yes.
Head and shoulders above the rest of us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's because after the Tylaxian flu, pretty much his head and shoulders are all that are left.
Yeah.
Sort of a disease of consumption. So anyway, hopefully you're listening to our podcast on iTunes or our website. Keep it up. If you're listening to us on iTunes, give us a good rating. If you're listening to us on our website, make sure to leave us a comment telling us how much you love everything we do or how much you hate everything we do. And the website is www.ragnarok.com. You could also send us an email if you want to get in touch with us, maybe a little more personal. Write Meyer a little love note. You could send that to info@ragnarok.com. And if you want us to leave us a breathy and awkward voicemail, you could do that. We will play them on the air. We've gotten some more.
We almost have enough for another segment.
Yeah, we need at least one more before we can really make a segment out of it.
Hey, Twizzle, earn your fucking shout-out, buddy.
Oh, yeah. And Twizzle. No, people don't just get shout-outs for being friends with Eric.
Earn it.
You gotta earn that Twizzle.
Yeah.
You gotta earn that shout out, Twizzle.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, what's the number?
Number is 516-362-6373. That's 516-362-NERD.
How about you vote too? How about that?
Yeah.
Twizzle?
So,
vote.
Twizzle, get off your pony loving ass and leave us a voicemail.
This episode just got really angry.
Twizzle, you have to earn that shout out.
Fucking earn it.
Yeah, earn it.
Voicemail. Rating on iTunes.
It's the
just
second episode now. So now you owe us a good rating on iTunes and a voicemail.
Pull your weight. And vote. How about you vote? Just pressing a fucking button.
It's not that hard, Twizzle. Come on. Even you could do it. So, until you do, you're going to be our whipping boy.
Yeah, we don't give handouts here, alright? You got to earn.
You got to earn your shout-outs.
It's what grown-ups do, okay, buddy?
Put your big boy pants on, Twizzle.
Yeah. Come on, Twizzle. Step it up. Alright. I think that takes care of our Twizzle beratement.
Yes, it does.
I think we've... Oh, you can also follow us on Twitter, @RagnarDrock.
Hear that, Twizzle?
Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter too, Twizzle. Or you can friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/RagnarDrock.
That's something you can do too.
Yeah, Twizzle can do that.
And if you don't want to get made fun of more, Twizzle, as we said, do something.
Yeah, because it's just going to get meaner.
In 2 weeks, it's going to be much meaner, and we can get... deep.
Yeah, they've just been, you know, brainstorming things to say.
I have a list.
And Meyer is he's learning the art of karate.
It's ninja jitsu.
Oh, sorry, he's learning jiu-jitsu. And he's in several years when he's mastered it, he's coming after you.
Yeah. So better get on it before then.
All right. Yep.
I think we put the fear of God in him.
Yeah,
I think so too.
And I'm learning by the Ninja Turtles.
Okay, by watching the show?
Yeah.
It's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, until next time, folks, I'm Alex.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Meyer.
And I'm Ed.
And this has been another episode of Ragnarok.